I'd like to first thank the organizers for inviting me here for a nice conference. Oh, is it not? No. Oh, it says on, yeah.
No, you're okay, it's on.
Simon?
It's only for record.
Ah, okay, only for the record, okay. All right. So, so what I'm going to talk about today is about possible quantum spinning phases when there is no spin rotation symmetry. So what I can promise you is that I'm not going to talk about modular unitary category. I think it's like something different. No, actually, just listening to the two talks in the morning, I felt like, you know, if you look at like sci-fi movies in 1960s, you know, there are all these, you know, people are commuting with the airplane with the propellers, looking at the computer screen, they're all CRT TV terminals. So I feel like I came with this technology here today to talk about old stuff.
You feel like a North Korean.
I don't make a political statement. Okay. So what am I going to do today is talk about the old slip particle formulation to think about possible spin liquid phases on various systems. So as a warm-up project, I'd like to first begin with Heisenberg guitar model on the honeycomb lattice. So it has been proposed this model may be relevant for so-called honeycomb iridate, some 5-deuterium metal oxide. And so here I'm gonna introduce various notations and all that. Then I'm gonna talk about Gagomel lattice spin liquid in the context of Herbert smithite. So this is supposed to be a promising candidate material for spin liquid phases in Gagomel lattice. And then if I have a time, then I move on to the next topic. There is, you know, I may be talking about magnets composed of non-Kramers doublet. So it's different from the ordinary spin. Okay, so the first topic. So this material actually exists in nature, this sodium iridate. It turns out that if you look at only the iridium site and they make a hexagon, and you can actually make a hexagonal or the honeycomb lattice out of this. The sodium is sitting in between, but this is non-magnetic. So if you're only thinking about a spin system, then basically you can make a network of hexagon, essentially. So this is one of those 5D transition metal oxide. It involves the 5D orbital that contains strong spin orbit coupling. And I'm not going to go into details, but essentially you can derive this model. And one thing I'd like to point out is that, you know, when I was giving something like this, then some high energy theory in the audience asked me, what is 5-dimensional transition metal oxide? But it's not. And it's not. Okay. Okay. So.
Inter-layer coupling.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So this is the model that you can derive from microscopics. So this is the Heisenberg part of the model. This is the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model. Then there's the Kitaev term. Namely, what actually happens is that if you look at the honeycomb lattice like this, then there are three kinds of link. For each link, you only have X. For one kind of link, we only have XX eigen coupling. And the other link, you have YY and ZZ like coupling. So that's the Kitaev model. And Kitaev model can be exactly solved. And this is one of those famous Kitaev's many models. if you look at this a model like this, so here is the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg part. This is the Kitaev part. Then it's clear that, for example, if this parameter alpha is 1, then you go back to the Kitaev limit. So you know that there's exact solution. So you have a quantum spin liquid. It's actually the G2 spin liquid. And if alpha is 0, then you're just getting a Heisenberg model, antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model on the bipartite lattice. So you just get a 2 sub lattice antiferromagnet. In between, you get what people call stripy antiferromagnet. So this is a 4 sub lattice antiferromagnet in contrast to the usual 2 sub lattice antiferromagnet. So in principle, you can have three different phases like that. And this phase diagram was obtained using some elementary method, such as something like spin wave expansion, et cetera, et cetera. But this phase diagram was confirmed by DMRG calculation, also functional imagination group study. So essentially, you get the same phases. So one thing I like to mention here is that these people did DMRG calculation, say, as a function of this coupling parameter alpha, but at the same time, they can also apply a magnetic field. So some of these phases basically become cantic. But if you look at the transition between a quantum spin liquid and a stripy antiferromagnet magnet in the presence of an external field, you notice that this is the blow up of this area in the phase diagram. So it looks as if, as you turn on the external field, then this whatever the transition point immediately gives up to a polarized phase. And so it looks as if the H equals zero transition could be continuous transition, such that when you turn on H, you may immediately open up a new phase. So this may or may not be an indication of second order transition, but even if it is first order transition, it's gonna be a weakly first order transition. So that's one interesting point that I'd like to make. Okay, so the question is, we have this model that is solved by that is solved in many different ways. So as a warm-up exercise, the question is, can we use a slave particle? In particular, I'm gonna use a slave fermion formulation. Can we describe such a transition using this elementary method? Okay, so it turns out that it's very useful to change the basis, so namely the spin quantization axis. So the idea is as follows. So imagine that I fix the spin quantization axis at the square lattice point. So the lattice point is represented by squares. Then you rotate the spins at the triangular, circular, and pentagonal side by 180 degrees along XYZ coordinate, XYZ bond. Then it turns out that the transformation basically changes the Hamiltonian. So if you look at the Heisenberg part, then it becomes like that. It becomes a combination of Heisenberg part and the Kitai model part. The Kitai model doesn't change. So at the end of the day, in the transformed or rotated spin basis, this is the Hamiltonian you get. So again, it's a combination of Heisenberg model and the Kitai model. But the difference is that both Hamiltonian now becomes ferromagnetic. Ferromagnetic. So previously, Heisenberg part was antiferromagnetic. In the new basis, Heisenberg part becomes a ferromagnetic. And you immediately notice that if alpha is 1/2, then you basically end up with an SU2 invariant ferromagnetic Heisenberg model. So alpha equals to 1/2 is a special point. So there's a hidden SU2 symmetry, namely that the stripy phase that we talked about in the middle of the phase diagram, in the rotated basis, just becomes an ordinary ferromagnet. So in this basis, it's pretty clear why you want to have a stripy phase, because this is the exact solution of this model. At alpha equals 1/2, you should get a ferromagnet. If I go back to the original spin basis, it becomes a stripy antiferromagnet. So here we have a transition between ferromagnetic state to a Kitai G2 spin liquid. When alpha equals to 1, basically you are going back to the Kitai model. So there we also know the solution. So you are basically trying to extrapolate one exact solution, that's a ferromagnet. The other exact solution, that's the G2 spin liquid. The question, how can you connect these two limits? Okay, so let's start with this parameterization. Here I just introduced another parameter delta. So delta equals 0 is the ferromagnetic point, and delta equals 1/2 is the Kitaev limit. Okay, so what I'm going to use is technology from the last century. So basically, use a slave particle approach. So I'm going to use a slave fermion approach. Okay. So you represent spin by a fermion with this constraint. So the point that I like to make is that since we are dealing with a ferromagnet, not the antiferromagnet, remember that in the usual antiferromagnet, you have to use sort of singlet spin singlet Minfield amplitude. But since we are dealing with a ferromagnet, you have to use a spin triplet version of the Minfield amplitude. So here, You allow a spin flip for the fermion hopping, and this is the fermion pairing, but this is not in a singlet sector, this is in a triplet sector. So it turns out that you have to do that to get a stable mean field solution. Okay, so this one, this basically the one major difference. Then since you also want to describe magnetic order, you also want to introduce some magnetic order parameter, M. So this is basically ferromagnetic order parameter. So let's go to, okay. So it turns out that, you know, in principle, there are many, many parameters. We discover that this 9-parameter model describes a saddle point solution very well. It basically gives you a minimum saddle point solution of this complicated infield theory. Okay, so let's start with the Kitaev limit, so there we know the exact solution. So we introduced these complex fermions, then it turns out you can make a 4 Majorana fermions out of this. I know that some of you are more familiar with Majorana fermions than ordinary fermions, so maybe now you make your new friend. Yeah.
So in this kind of theory,
how do we impose this constraint in the mean field theory? You did not mention the constraint. So I'm at the moment I'm doing just a mean field theory. So this constraint is
what kind of constraint in the mean field? It's just a normal.
Just single side, yeah. That constraint is exactly the same. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So here is your familiar friend, the Majorana fermions. So if you use this Majorana representation, then you can immediately see that the fermion occupation constraint I talked about immediately becomes the constraint of the Majorana fermion like this. And all the spin operator can be written in a quadratic form using this Majorana degree of freedom. And the Hamiltonian can be written like that in a Majorana representation. So in this mean field theory, it becomes quadratic in terms of those Majorana degree of freedom. And you can show that the Kitaev limit corresponds to some particular combination of these mean field parameters. And in fact, if you do a very naive mean field calculation, indeed you can recover this Kitaev limit. So you get some number, but they all become equal. So that basically we can recover the Kitaev solution even in this naive mean field theory. Okay, so here is the spectrum of the spin-on. Remember that there are four kinds of Majorana fermions, chi 0, 1, 2, 3. So you can show that these flat bands are basically coming from chi 1, chi 2, chi 3 Majorana fermion, and dispersing band is coming from chi 0 Majorana fermion. And this basically represents the gapless G2 spin Leakey state. Here there's a Dirac fermions at the chemical potential. And you can also immediately realize that if I think about a spin-spin correlator in a mean field theory, you have a decomposition like this. And since chi 1, chi 2, chi 3 fermions, they all have a flat band, because of that, they are pretty localized. And that's one of the reasons why this spin-spin correlation function becomes immediately short range. So this essentially, is also recovering the Kitaev solution. So much for the Kitaev solution. So what about the transition? So I'm talking about a transition in the mean field theory. So it turns out that this is the G2 spin liquid, and what plays a role of charge to Higgs in the G2 spin liquid here is the field that I introduced E. So you can show that when I change delta, so here is the Kitaev spin liquid, here is the ferromagnet. Then when you have a transition from spin liquid to ferromagnet, so there's a ferromagnetic transition here. But at the same time, your Higgs field basically goes to zero. So in the mean field theory, Higgs field goes to zero, but then your ferromagnetic order parameter becomes finite. So this is the first transition. But the point is that, strictly speaking, this is the ferromagnetic star phase. So what I mean by star is actually, I think, Sentil and Fisher introduced this terminology, that this guy is actually fractionalized. So we are doing a mean field theory. So these fermions are still fractionalized, even though it's ferromagnet, and the magnetization is finite. But if you look at the spectrum, then you immediately realize that this ferromagnetic star phase cannot possibly be stable, because what happens is as follows. So remember that there was a flat band. So flat band acquires a dispersion as you get away from the Kitaev limit. But then when you get into a ferromagnetic star phase, you immediately open up a gap in the spin-on spectrum. So we know that in two dimensions, if you have a gap U1 spin liquid, that's unstable because of the instanton events. So that suggests that this is actually not a ferromagnetic star phase. If you include low energy fluctuation, it should become a conventional ferromagnet. And that's the way that you can describe a transition from gapless G2 spin liquid, a Kitaev spin liquid, to a conventional ferromagnet. So the point is, in mean field theory, this transition is first order. And the reason for that is obvious, because we are treating this charged Higgs field as an order parameter. And there's another order parameter, this magnetization. So if I just try to write down a Landau theory for these two order parameters, then I will just get a first order transition, because I have two competing order parameters.
But why this coexistence phase is impossible? Because the coexistence phase in principle, just as Z2 is not E1, right? So,
you mean the when charge Higgs is zero?
Yeah.
And magnetic tension is finite?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like we don't get that. We only get we only get that at the transition point.
I see. But in general, we also
yeah, you could get a
coexisting phase.
I agree with you. Yeah. Okay.
Can you connect bisons and go?
We didn't try that. I think that's another way to do it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's all about, you know, so for example, we can ask, you know, can we have a continuous transition, right? That will be more interesting, right? And the point is that the reason why I get a force of transition is obvious in the mean field theory, because I have two competing order parameters. But we know that this field is not physical order parameter, right? It's not a gauge invariant object. So this, obviously, if you go beyond the mean field theory, you can, in principle, get something more interesting. So if you have you could have a continuous transition, but it has to be the case that if that happens, then Higgs transition and confinement transition should happen at the same time in the language of slave particle formulation. So that could be an interesting critical point. So we didn't really work out, but perhaps in order to do this properly, we probably have to think about a bison theory, essentially. Yeah. Starting from the Kitaya model.
So the numerics, what's known about the bison gap as you approach this transition?
We don't know. Oh, you mean the DMRG calculation?
Does there any information on?
We don't know. I don't think there is a clear information about that.
Actually, from the numerical calculation, it looks like a pretty like a second order. I mean, you can enlarge this kind of parameter space and put many different kind of parameters in the phase diagram, and they always like transition happen at the same point.
No, but is there any information whether the Weisshorn gap goes to zero with the transition or stays fine?
That's very hard to determine because of the finite size aspect. So just do some extrapolation and you find that this coincide for this condition point.
Okay. So let's move on to the next topic. So so Herbert Smith type. Okay. So this is the material. Some of you probably see this figure many times before. For some people, maybe the first time. The point is that these are the copper ion, and those are the oxygen. So if you only connect the green dot, this copper moment, then it basically becomes a Kagome lattice. And one way to think about this system is as follows. So imagine that I start from a particle lattice, that's a corner shading tetrahedron. And imagine that initially I had all a copper moment sitting on this side of the particle lattice. Then you look at the one-on-one axis, one-on-one direction, then you realize that you can think about the particle lattice as a collection of Kagome triangle, Kagome triangle, Kagome triangle. Then you replace all the copper side on the triangle lattice by a zinc. Then you can separate all the Kagome lattice. And in fact, that's the way that you create a Kagome lattice system of copper ion. So in fact, that's the way that they made the system. So, okay. So this is supposed to be close to the nearest neighbor anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg model. The J is around 200 Kelvin. So there are lots of stories about nearest neighbor Heisenberg anti-ferromagnetic model. I mean, it goes back to, again, previous centuries. A lot of us looked at this problem. And the, one of the most recent calculations is a DMRG calculation. It suggests that a ground state may be a gap spill, okay? And entanglement entropy with J2 by J1 about 0.1 suggests that it is indeed a G2 spin-locket according to this topological entanglement entropy. So the question is, which spin-locket state is this, right? Well, which G2 spin-locket state is this? That's essentially one of the interesting questions one can ask. There are various slave particle calculations. So for example, if you just think about a slave fermion formulation with a projection, then typically you actually get a U1 Dirac fermion spin locket, not a G2 spin locket. But they also discovered that if you add ferromagnetic J2, then you can stabilize a 36 site balanced Bose solid state. There's a more recent calculation by Motrinich's group, and you can actually do a bosonic projection, bosonic wave function projection. Then when J2 is sufficiently big, they discover that Suvius old spin locket state becomes the ground state. It actually wins over the U1 Dirac fermion state in terms of energetics. So it looks like there's a pretty good evidence that at least when J2 is sufficiently big, it's going to be a G2 spin locket. When J2 becomes smaller, you may be facing more stiff competition with all kinds of other states. Okay. So, but for real material, the situation is a little bit more complicated because it's not like we only have a Niels-Neve antiferromagnet Heisenberg model. So there's also Jalotinsky-Moria interaction according to experiment. And the strength of the Jalotinsky-Moria interaction is about J by 10. So it's small, but it could be a substantial perturbation given that we have a lot of competing spin liquid phases. And there's also Ising type EG axis interaction. There's also order of J by 10. And perhaps next nearest neighbor interaction could be present, even though it's supposed to be small, according to electronic structure calculation. So imagine that I take all of this and try to come up with a spin locket state, okay? And see how can you possibly distinguish different phases, different spin locket phases in the presence of all of this perturbation. Okay, it's a weak perturbation, but hope maybe these perturbations are important. Okay, so again, so going back to slave particle construction, for the usual spin rotation invariant case, that we usually just take these two kinds of mean field amplitude, the singlet type hopping and pairing. Okay, so then you construct a quadratic Hamiltonian. This is the starting point of your mean field theory using this two component spinner representation. So this Uij matrix represents the mean field Hamiltonian. This chi and eta is basically here. And you have a gauge redundancy. So there are lots of gauge equivalent state. But if you don't have a spin rotation invariant, then you must introduce two other order parameters. So again, you have to use this spin flip type hopping and the spin triplet type pairing. Okay. So what that means is that if you construct a mean field Hamiltonian, then you should write this in a four component basis, just like dealing with triplet superconductor. Essentially, your mean field Hamiltonian looks like the very general BCS Hamiltonian with an arbitrary spin non-conserving hopping and that singlet and triplet basically pairing field. So you basically need all of those parameters. Okay. But it turns out that in our case, it's relatively simpler because it turns out that we can just keep the G component of these new order parameters because our model still has the U1 symmetry left. So for example, I introduced the Jalotinsky-Moria interaction that still, keep the U1 symmetry intact. So in this case, it's relatively simpler, so you can ignore those guys because they become a repulsive channel. So if you do that, then you can still keep the same spinner structure like a previous case. So that immediately tells us that in this case, basically the gauge redundancy is the same as before. Okay, so it simplifies the problem. And the algebraic PSG, the projective symmetry group, is essentially the same. Okay? It doesn't actually change. Okay. So what that is a good news because then what that means is that I can take all the solutions I had in the singlet channel, then I can adiabatically deform it to a spin locket state in the presence of spin rotation breaking perturbation. Okay. So okay.
This is also XY magnetic order.
XY magnetic order?
Yeah.
No. Then it doesn't work. So as I said, in general, you need all of these parameters. Maybe I didn't understand your question.
You just had only the Jalotinsky-Moria. That prefers a certain XY state, XY anti-ferromagnetic state.
That's right.
Is that allowed?
Here it's not allowed because here I'm assuming that if Jalotinsky-Moria is really big,
yeah,
then of course you eventually get into that ordered state.
Yeah.
So that you, this model cannot describe it, basically. Yeah.
So you're keeping DZ or also the in-plane dilution schema? Yeah.
So then again, you have to go back to this four component spin representation if you want to keep the in-plane dilution schema real interaction. So here I'm only keeping the G axis. Yeah. That's why it becomes a little simpler. Yeah. Okay. So if you do that, then if you require that you only want to keep nearest neighbor and second neighbor mean field amplitude to be finite, third neighbor and higher amplitude is zero. Imagine that you require that you only have 8 G2 spin liquid. So 8 sounds like a big number, but actually if you don't require that, you have a 20. So it's already simplified, right? Okay. You have 8 G2 spin liquid. And here people use this notation that the first index is the flux through gauge flux through triangle. Second index is gauge flux through the hexagon. So you get this list. So this 8 G2 spin liquid, and these are parent nuance spin liquid. And the point is that even though spin on spectrum is not gauge invariant, so I mean it's actually in a way it doesn't make sense to really talk about the spin on spectrum, but it still gives us some insight. So one thing you want to know is that, for example, this is U1 0 pi Dirac fermion state. So remember that was the state that the variation of Monte Carlo always finds it as the ground state. But once you introduce triplet contribution, then this Dirac point basically immediately gaps out. So any small perturbation will gap out this Dirac point. Okay. Another state of interest is that among all these 8 G2 state, only this state has a full gap. So if you want to make a connection to DMRG results, and then you have a gap state, then in a way, this is really the only possible candidate in the context of slave fermion mean field state. Okay? And this guy is still gap, even in the presence of spin on isotropy perturbation. Another point I'd like to make is that this state is unstable. Just, again, this is two-dimensional gapped U1 spin liquid. So perhaps, in the context of experiment, this state is probably, not very important anyway, right? Because it's just not stable in the presence of spin rotation symmetric breaking perturbation. Okay. Okay. So then, can you actually distinguish different kinds of spin liquid phases? Okay. So initially I thought, maybe a good idea to look at spin structure factor, because that's a gauge invariant object, right? So that's basically, if you do a neutron scattering, you can measure the scattering cross section because of spin flip. And you have to basically excite spin on anti-spin on excitation continuum. So it is generally expected that you will get a continuum of state because of the spin on. And this is basically what the dynamical spin structure factor looks like around some extended Abelian zone. And you see that, okay, so you see that, so generally the G2 spin liquid state has a much less dispersion compared to the U1 state. But on the other hand, there are a lot of excitation. There are a lot of continuum of excitation. Okay? So it's actually not that easy to distinguish different spin liquid phases. Yeah.
For this zero pi state, if you look at this kind of lower edge of the dispersion, do they double in the Brillouin zone? They repeat themselves.
Right. So this is the original Brillouin zone.
I see.
And this is the extended Brillouin zone, and this is drawn in the extended Brillouin zone because of that. So it's actually double. Yeah. Okay. And if you add a triplet component. Remember that I can adiabatically deform my single state to triplet state. So if you add a triplet component, then you do see a change. And this green is positive change and purple is a negative change. So it's actually very difficult to see here. So I'm going to summarize the result. Okay. So first of all, generally there's a lot of diffuse scattering in the sense that there are a lot of scattering that don't necessarily have a strong dispersion in it. And this may be consistent neutron scattering. I'm gonna show you neutron scattering later. Another thing is that when spin rotation symmetry is broken, so by adding a triplet component, and there's a spectral wave transfer to the zone center. So the point is that if you have a strict spin notation invariance, then Q equals zero structure fact in the low energy limit is exactly zero. The total spin is conserved. There's no scattering, right? So obviously that's what you see if you only have a spin notation invariance. But when you break that spin notation invariance, then you see more scattering near the Jones center, right? You see a more scattering. And it essentially makes the dispersion to be less momentum dependent compared to the single and only model. But if spin rotation symmetric breaking perturbation is weak, then again, intensity near the Jones center has to be still small, right? Because it's supposed to be zero without perturbation. Okay. So here's the neutron scattering data. So here is this is the extended Brillouin zone that I talked about. Here's the Jones center. Remember the scattering intensity repeats in this zone, in the extended zone. And there are two scans here. It's this plot represents this scan, and that scan represents here. So notice that this scan goes through the gamma point, and this scan does not go through the gamma point. So for this scan, intensity indeed drops near the gamma point, right? So here, intensity actually drops. It's a good sign. It means that the spin rotation symmetry breaking perturbation is actually weak. Right? That's why intensity near the gamma point is smaller. Okay, but nonetheless, other than that, basically you don't really see much dispersion. You know, it's just continual scattering. So that, you know, could be explained by this presence of scattering intensity over a very large energy window. And so since
in all the Zeekers and liquid, there's certainly a lot of dispersion even in that direction.
Yes. So the point is as follows. So indeed there's a dispersion here. But the point is that in the neutron scattering, they actually have to chop off the energy below 1 mV. Because below that, basically, you get a signal from the impurities. So you know, so the claim is that in order to really see, you know, that was our dream, right? To identify the bottom of the spin-on continuum and see which spin-liquid state, you know, is possible, is realized in the real experiment. At the moment, you know, all these low energy scales are all masked by all this impurity contribution. So unfortunately, we don't see that. It's a practical problem. So,
but if you do the intensity plot,
yes,
even for Z2, whether you have a similar result or not, because of the some dispersion model,
yes,
have a very low weight, probably you don't.
Yes, sir. So I have a different proposal though.
Okay.
So the different proposal is an electron spin resonance. Okay. So here is one way to do it. So imagine, what is electron spin resonance? So this is an absorption of a microwave field with some microwave field that's it's a transverse field, right? With a frequency omega and polarization alpha by applying an external Zeeman field. So imagine I apply Zeeman field along the g-axis, then I apply a transverse a polarization field. Then you can show that the electron spin resonance intensity, absorption intensity looks like this. Is proportional to structure factor near Q equals zero because microwave has a long wavelength, right? So it's a way to measure structure factor at the near the Jones center at finite frequency. Okay, yeah. So and it's finite only when the spin rotation symmetry is broken. So otherwise, you know, it's zero, right? So typically, what you do because of that, you apply a Zeeman field. So that's gonna So if there's no other spin on isotropy, you will only get a Zeeman response. Okay, so you have a resonance at the Zeeman energy. But otherwise, if there are perturbations other than Zeeman field, then there may be other contributions to this ESR spectrum. Okay, so you compute this ESR spectrum. Basically, what it does is, you know, you Zeeman split all the spin on bands. So then you basically are probing the Zeeman split, you know, or the transition between the different levels, right? So then different spin liquid actually shows kind of different behavior. And the reason why this could be useful is that, you know, these energy scales are all pushed up around the Zeeman energy scale, right? So it's not necessarily a very, you know, very small energy scale. So perhaps around the Zeeman energy scale, we can see a better sort of more distinguished structure, right? So that's basically the, okay. So the ESR may be a useful tool to distinguish different quantum spin-like phases. So it's basically taking the advantage of spin-on isotropy to probe the underlying spin-like state. So as far as, you know, this gentle perturbation does not destroy, completely destroy the spin-like state, we can probably use that to probe the nature of this underlying spin-like state. That's essentially the proposal. So yeah, how much time do I?
Two or three minutes for questions.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so briefly. I'm gonna be quick, yeah. So. Okay, so this is something new that my student and I came up with. So the spin orbital liquid non-Kramers magnet. So how do I think about that? So imagine that I have a ion like this, crystalline 3 plus. In this case, I have two electrons in the f orbital, so a little bit of quantum chemistry. And in local some crystal field environment, it turns out that you make this atomic state, so J equal 4 state. Okay. So in this case, because of this crystal field due to oxygen ions around the crystalline ion, your J equal 4 multiplet is split. And the important point is that the ground state is a non-Kramers doublet. What that means is that I have a doublet protected by crystal symmetry, but they are not related by time reversal, right? So that's why it's called non-Kramers doublet. What is interesting about this system is that this non-Kramers pseudo-spin degree of freedom behaves like this. So the G component looks like a usual magnetic dipolar degree of freedom, but the XY part is like a quadrupolar degree of freedom. It's not a dipolar degree of freedom. And in that case, the time reversal symmetry, sends the sigma x and sigma y to the same thing, but only the G component changes sign. So your T square is 1, and the time reversal operator sigma 1k. It's not sigma 2k. Usually it's a sigma 2k for the Kramers doublet. Here it's different. So if you write down all the symmetry allowed pseudo-spin model, then it's usually very non-Heisenberg-like. Okay, very non-Heisenberg-like. Okay, so let's consider, say, possible quantum spin liquid phases with those degree of freedom. So basically, what is going to be different? There is a difference between Kramers and non-Kramers cases. And the point is the action of time reversal symmetry is different because the time reversal operator is different. Yeah? Okay. So I think I'm going to skip all of that. Skip all of that. So we did. Okay, here it is. Okay. So what we did, we looked at this system on a Kagome lattice. Then the point is that algebraic PSG is essentially the same for the Kramers and non-Kramers case. But the solution is different. Okay. So for example, you can show that there's all of the solution to PSG, the gauge transformation that corresponds to time reversal operator has this solution with the plus minus one. And when the gauge group, invariant gauge group is G2, for the Kramers case, only one of the cases actually allow a non-trivial solution. It turns out that for non-Kramers case, you actually allow the other solution. So you actually generate a new spin-like state. So that's one message that I like to deliver, that you can, in principle, generate a different kinds of spin-like phases if you make such a state out of a non-Kramers doublet. So I think I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
This non-Kramers doublet.
Yes.
Is it an accidental degeneracy or there is a fine-tuning? What is the origin of that?
So as far as there's no distortion of the oxygen environment, then this it's basically protected by crystal symmetry. So for example, if you distort the oxygen cage, then in principle you can split the degeneracy.
The square or cubic?
It's a square-ish, it's a distorted cube. Yeah. So in fact, I didn't talk about that. In fact, you can use that to design an experiment. So for example, this non-Kramers doublet couples to the EG mode of the oxygen cage distortion. So when this mode is actually Raman active, right? So if you do a Raman at low temperature, the Raman peak will basically become broadened because this phonon mode can decay into this non-Kramers spin-on degree of freedom.
And this channel doesn't exist for the Cramer's doublet. So this is one way to detect the non-Cramer's nature of the